You're listening to local and regional news on KMUN. I'm Ava Berardi. Two more candidates have emerged in the race to be Astoria's next mayor. Katie Frankowitz reports.
One of the candidates is already a familiar face at the city council dais. Former city councilor Tom Brownson has announced he'll be running for mayor. He previously held the Ward 2 seat, representing Astoria's South Slope. He was first elected in 2016 and re-elected in 2020. In 2024, he announced he would not run again and instead made an unsuccessful bid for a seat on the Port of Astoria Commission. He decided to run once again for a seat on the Astoria City Council after hearing incumbent Mayor Sean Fitzpatrick would not seek a second four-year term. Combat veteran Sean Davis is vying for the seat, and Brownson feels voters should have multiple options to choose from. He says he's not running with any particular agenda in mind, but feels he is well qualified to tackle the challenges of the role of mayor.
The issues that they've been dealing with are just extensions of issues that I was dealing with for the last 8 years. None of this is new. One of the things that I bring to the continuing discussion and process is a knowledge of how we got here.
He points to recent difficult discussions at the city council around various policies to address homeless camps downtown.
For issues like that, one of the things that I can do is that I can help facilitate the discussions and allow them to be a little bit more straightforward and get where you can go with what you've got. Because again, we're still limited. There's only so much the city can or cannot do. So when your choices and resources are severely limited, people want more than you can give. And you've got to be able to communicate that to everybody and get everybody to work under the same understanding of what the potential solutions are.
Brownson also points to his past involvement as a city councilor in the partnership with the Port of Astoria on that entity's waterfront revitalization plan. He believes his experience there could be an asset to keep the project moving forward. He says he wants to make sure people feel they are heard, but he also sees another obligation as mayor.
To be supportive of staff, city staff, to protect city staff, unless they're doing something wrong, to otherwise help them do their job and be as effective as possible. I get a sense that staff has had a hard time the last couple of years, that it's been really difficult for them, and that they're really frustrated. And I think that's something, as mayor, I can do something to help.
Brownson is in the middle of collecting the signatures he needs to proceed as a candidate. One of his potential opponents is also busy collecting signatures. Laura Parker is a seventh-generation Astorian and currently works as a juvenile probation counselor for the Clatsop County Juvenile Department. While she has been involved in many aspects of the community over the years, the mayoral race marks her first time running for elected office.
I really want to see Astoria be as successful as it can be and should be. We are natural resource rich here. We have people here that love Astoria. Like, whether it's generational Astorians or people that have moved here to be here, there's not a lot of people here that are like, I really don't like Astoria.
Parker feels her long history of involvement in the community and her experience working for government make her a strong contender. Among her priorities, if elected, include public safety, transparency at City Hall, and economic development. Parker says her work with the juvenile department has given her a particular perspective on challenges families and youth face in the area.
When we're looking at getting kids into school and attendance and things like that, and I remember thinking some of the barriers of just like simply like, man, some kids don't have the ability to do laundry or, running water isn't always in homes in the same way or, things like that we kind of take for granted. So that part for sure, families obviously struggling with substance abuse and, incarcerated parents, all of those types of things. It definitely, all of those things give me a different view.
Discussions around homelessness and housing have dominated many city council meetings over the past few years. Parker's opponent, Tom Brownson, was on the city council when city leaders first established the time, place, and manner ordinances for camping in the city. Ordinances the current city council has since revisited. Recent debates, especially around housing and homelessness, have been contentious, both in the community and at the dais. A majority of city councilors shot down a proposal to temporarily exclude people from the downtown area if they repeatedly violated certain rules. Law enforcement had argued exclusion zones would have been an important tool to help them enforce the city rules. Parker says if she had been on council, she likely would have voted in favor of the exclusion zones.
As long as there is shelter beds available, and as long as it's, you know, we're in the parameters of not being in any legal trouble, I think that having a clean and safe downtown should be a priority of the city and the mayor. And I certainly have talked to many constituents in this last week who have really voiced that concern to me more than I thought would have, quite frankly.
If they advance as candidates, Parker and Thompson will face off against Sean Davis, a combat veteran and the co-founder of the nonprofit Rogue Cell that works to connect veterans to community. Davis announced his intent to run for mayor earlier this year, running on a platform that emphasizes housing for working families, a coordinated plan around addressing homelessness that moves people towards stability, living wage jobs beyond tourism, emergency preparedness, and investments in critical city infrastructure. After he announced his candidacy, Davis said he hoped to face challengers in the mayoral race. Current Mayor Sean Fitzpatrick ran unopposed for his seat in 2022. This was an outlier in Astoria's recent history. In elections stretching back more than 20 years, the seat has always seen multiple challengers. I'm Katie Frankowitz, reporting for KMUN. Oregon Senator Ron Wyden says he's planning to introduce a bill in Congress that is inspired by Oregon's efforts to prevent corporate takeovers in medicine. At a roundtable in Eugene Tuesday, Wyden heard from both patients and providers who said they were frustrated by increasing interference from insurance companies and for-profit interests. The panel included members of Eugene Emergency Physicians, the first organization to use Oregon's law to sue their hospital to prevent it from replacing them with an out-of-state staffing company.
I love the fact that they took on private equity right here in this town. I mean, this is all about taking on these big lobbies, and that's what's going on here.
Wyden says along with addressing corporate decision-making in medicine, he hopes to take on prescription drug costs and rollback cuts in H.R. 1, the Republican tax bill that placed new limits on who can qualify for Medicaid.
Oregon lags behind the national average for regular school attendance, but an analysis by Oregon Journalism Project shows the state's school attendance rate saw more than a 1% bump this past school year. Black students made the largest gains, with attendance climbing from 56% to 62%. Malheur County has the highest rate of regular attendance at 83%, while Wheeler County has the lowest attendance at 41%. Oregon schools still lag far behind the national average, with 1 in 3 students being chronically absent. Starting this fall, a new law will require that the State Department of Education shares school attendance data 4 times a year. Jessica Cobian, policy manager at Stand for Children, says that having statewide attendance data in near real time allows Oregon schools to more quickly address students' problems. This story comes to us from a news partnership with Oregon Journalism Project and was reported on by Kushbu Rathor. With wildfires battering much of the western United States, practitioners of one fuel mitigation strategy have seen increased public interest. They work long hours, remove brush on difficult terrain, and chew cud. NWPB's Rachel Sun reports.
On a late July morning on a rocky slope near Spokane, Washington, Craig Madsen is watching his goats attack snowberry bushes, hawthorn, and Oregon grape. Madsen is renting his herd out for an important job, removing brush that could act as a carrier fuel for wildfires and threaten a nearby home. On this property, the homeowners use a tractor to clear fuel in other areas, but that doesn't work on the hill.
This part is because of the slope and the brush. They can't really use the equipment on, so we use the goats on to knock back the brush.
It's not exactly a new strategy, But increasingly, landowners are exploring their options. Morris Robinette is a cattle farmer in Cheney, Washington. He first took an interest in targeted grazing for fuel mitigation 3 years ago when a fire hit two different neighbors' properties. The first neighbor...
They had done several fuel reduction and DNR-sponsored fuel reduction projects on his place. And then he had also grazed really, really hard.
So when the fire reached a major highway...
It had a lot less energy and it did not jump the road.
A second neighbor hadn't done any of that fuel reduction. Robinette points to the spot on the map across the highway from the second neighbor's property where the fire did jump.
And burned another 500 acres, I guess.
He says because fire jumped from that second neighbor's property, at least six homes were threatened.
Firefighting had happened there because of a management decision made up here.
According to data from the National Interagency Fire Center, wildfire suppression cost an average of around $1,200 per acre in 2023. Costs to use goats for fuel reduction are often a few hundred dollars per acre. Prices vary depending on factors including time spent and desired outcomes. Matt Reeves, a research ecologist at the U.S. Forest Service, says goats could be well suited to what you might call point protection scenarios in small spaces.
People think also goats are cute. They're curious about them, and it's a great conversation starter. And the Forest Service and the BLM both are beginning to, I think, quite dramatically increase the number of projects where they're using goats.
Land managers are quick to point out that grazing and browsing animals can't be used everywhere. A few limitations include the number of animals available for a job, specific timing needed to protect native plants, and the cost to transport animals. Sometimes grazing can be used in conjunction with other fuel mitigation techniques like prescribed fire. Back in Cheney, Robinette walks me around his property and tells me he's also looking into controlled burns. But grazing is less of a liability.
The downside of prescribed burns is it can get away from you. Yeah. And the guy who lit the match is responsible for damages. And that's a huge deterrent.
Reef says government agencies are in the process of collecting data related to the efficacy of targeted grazing for fire prevention. Right now, there isn't much research available.
We are really anxious to partner with people and organizations to try and make that happen. We can't do it by ourselves.
Reef says there's no one solution to wildfire problems, but with mindful application, grazing could be a helpful tool for fuel mitigation. In Spokane, I'm Rachel Sun.
You're listening to KMUN. You're listening to local and regional news on KMUN. Now moving to news from Washington. The 2026 commercial albacore tuna season is off to a limping start, beleaguered by high fuel prices, sporadic fishing, and fewer fishermen. Landings this season are on pace to set a record low for Washington. The metric tons of tuna landed so far is only about 5% of the total landed last year, according to the Pacific Fisheries Information Network. Participation in the fishery is also down, with just over 50 vessels participating this season compared to more than 120 last season. Soaring gas prices have made offshore trips increasingly less lucrative to commercial fishermen who already operate on tight margins. Still, there's time for the season to turn around. August has historically been a month with the biggest landings.
This story comes to us through a news partnership with the Chinook Observer. Online at chinookobserver.com.
Washington officials say over 20 large fires are burning during what Governor Bob Ferguson says may be the worst fire season in state history. He announced Monday that he's waiving the enforcement of some state laws to speedy recovery. KNKX's Anna Marie Yanni has more.
The governor's updated emergency proclamation applies to 10 counties and tribal nations. Ferguson addressed residents from Spokane City Hall.
Many Washingtonians, as you know, have lost literally everything, including critical personal documents like their driver's license, ID card, birth certificate, and vehicle and vessel titles.
State officials will be at an emergency center in Spokane this week to help people get new copies. Other changes focus on letting healthcare providers stand up more services and expanding access to state assistance and unemployment programs. Next, local officials are applying for a federal major disaster declaration, like the one that was granted after December's floods.
I'm very aware that these major disaster declarations are not always granted, and so we are determined to make our case as compelling as possible.
The declaration would unlock FEMA assistance for individuals recovering from the fires. FEMA is already providing support with emergency shelter. I'm Anna Marie Yanni reporting.
Does Washington State go too easy on kids caught with guns? Some officials say yes. This after two teens were involved in a shootout at Seattle Food Festival in July. Reporter Sarah Mises-Tan has more.
Gunshots fired during the festival sent large crowds of people running and screaming through Seattle Center. Details about the teens involved in the shooting are still scarce, but we do know that one of them died at the scene, along with two bystanders. We also know that this teen was arrested 2 years ago for illegal gun possession.
19-year-old Junior Nico Samo had previously been involved in a shooting in South Seattle. In that 2024 case, police say he was illegally in possession of a handgun that had a modified Glock switch.
That audio is from Como News. A judge dismissed Nico Samo's old gun case in 2025. A year later, he was dead. And his story has drawn attention to how the state handles young people caught with guns. Washington has a five-strike law for people under 18. Each time they're caught with a gun, up to five times, a judge could put them in a detention center for under a month, or recommend community service, or impose a fine, or do nothing at all. After the fifth time, more serious consequences kick in, like months behind bars. And that five-strike law is aimed at addressing root causes of gun violence instead of locking kids up for long periods of time.
So we really need to take seriously gun possession in this country, but the idea that we can solve this problem by coming down hard on youth is a misguided approach.
Josh Rovner is a senior research analyst at the Sentencing Project. It's a criminal justice reform group based in D.C. Rovner says that nationwide, penalties for juvenile gun possession tend to be not as harsh as adult sentences. That's because research shows that more time spent in detention centers can be harmful to young people.
You know, sending a kid away from home interrupts their education, it interrupts their employment, any number of things in their lives that offer some stability.
He says the longer a child spends in a detention center, the more likely they are to repeat crimes and return to jail. They're also more likely to experience mental health problems later on. But some lawmakers and prosecutors think Washington's five-strike law is too lenient on kids.
By the time they got to five, they would already have committed a serious offense, or they were shot and killed themselves.
That's Renton Democrat David Hackney. He tried to reform the five-strike law last year. He thought three strikes would be better, but his bill didn't go anywhere. It didn't even get a hearing.
My colleagues in the legislature, they called juvenile justice reform basically making it harder and harder to incarcerate juveniles. They say it traumatizes them. So does violent crime traumatize the community.
Hackney worked with King County prosecutor Lisa Mannion to try and change the law. She also wants fewer strikes before a judge can send a kid to jail for longer periods of time. Longer than a month.
I am not trying to incarcerate more youth, but I do think that waiting until the fifth conviction of a young person carrying a firearm, it sends maybe the unintended message to young people that carrying a firearm is not a big deal.
She believes that if youth can be put in jail sooner and for longer than 30 days, officials might have a better chance to connect them with programming that can change their lives, get them out of dangerous situations, and get them to stop carrying guns.
What I really want to do is to offer young people interventions at an earlier point in time, because I really want us to try to change juvenile thinking and behavior as it comes to possessing firearms.
And she hopes that might stop them from committing more serious crimes that could get them sentenced as adults, like homicide. Mannion plans to work with Representative Hackney again next year to try and change the five-strike law. In Olympia, I'm Sarah Mises-Tan.
Local and regional news is brought to you by our news partners and by the KMUN News Team. For more local and regional news, go to kmun.org/news. You're listening to KMUN.